A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, I'm Leighton Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Mats Wilander.
Hi, this is Charlie's mum, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. And this week, this special week, brought to you in association with Kay Anderson Chivers. That was Kay's voice that you heard in her intro. And Kay, as she explained in her intro, is the mum of Charlie the Ferret, one of our very favourite hashtag tennis podcast pets, David Law.
Yeah, and there are so many of them. And Charlie has his own Twitter account, and I've been following his journey. Instagram, in fact.
Journey.
I do get my social media mixed up.
Following his journey.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, Charlie the Ferret is a tennis podcast listener, and we're very grateful for the support given us to by Kay Anderson Chivers. Thank you very much.
We are. Can I suggest, Kay, that maybe Charlie considers trying his hand at tennis predicting? Because animals, it turns out, are quite good at that. So, just a thought to see if Charlie's got it in him to, I don't know, predict the winner of the French Open or something like that. But anyway, we love him regardless of his predicting skills. And we're very happy to have his mum on our intro this week. David Law, of BT Sport fame and BBC Radio and all the rest of it, joins me, of course. David, how's your week been?
Oh, it's been glorious. Glorious weather at the weekend in the UK. Even you seem jolly, so it must have been good. And I was watching and listening, or most specifically listening, to the Masters Golf last night and getting hammered by various people on social media about my comparison of Sergio Garcia, who had turned pro 17 years before he finally won a major
tournament.
We're not
doing this, David.
And
it's
Goran Ivanišević, who 14 years after turning pro finally won his first major. Both
But it's a completely different sport. Those years, in the context of the sport, those years don't mean the same thing. It is an absurd comparison.
No, it isn't.
It's absurd.
No, it's a very, very good one. In terms of feel, you have two hugely popular sports people who everybody assumed time had passed and would never actually win a major title. But lo and behold, Goran Ivanišević walked through the gates of Wimbledon and managed to win the tournament, and lo and behold, the Masters, such a similar tournament to Wimbledon in its own right, and Sergio Garcia.
Well, because there's grass there.
No, because of prestige and tradition and all the rest of it. I'm right.
I find it truly preposterous. I the extent to which I would agree is only that there's a certain amount of emotion and sentimentality wrapped up in Sergio Garcia's victory, which I think is wonderful, and I partook in that as well, which there was also with Goran. But that, for me, is where the comparison
ends.
I'm presenting, so we're moving
That's
straight
all you
on.
Need. Romanticism.
We'll just say that. Don't defend it with ridiculous statistics.
Such as Goran Ivanišević finally winning through after three runners-up appearances in the Wimbledon final, and Sergio Garcia having 4 seconds in major tournaments before finally getting through. Such similarities reign.
We've started off the podcast on a really bum note here because I'm genuinely annoyed.
Excellent.
Genuinely annoyed. He was 40-1, Sergio Garcia. He's the number 11 in the world. I'm not even engaging in this. It's like arguing with a child about whether Santa Claus exists. This is absurd.
Let's talk about
the Davis Cup, David. Let's talk about the Davis Cup because tennis has been happening. Tennis. Like tennis, don't we?
It's good tennis, isn't it? It's much more energetic for a start. I mean,
It is. Yeah, it's not just sort of walking.
Except the way I play.
In orange trousers.
I do a lot of walking.
A lot of orange trousers at the Masters, weren't there? I find it really hard to take them seriously when they're wearing orange trousers. Anyway, I'm going to do it in the order that they are on the Davis Cup website rather than being British and myopic. So we're not going to deal with the France GB tie first. We're going to talk about Belgium first. That David nation, I mean David in terms of David and Goliath.
I'm all for a David
nation. They're amazing,
nation.
Aren't they, Belgium? They're amazing in the Davis Cup. They're into the semi-finals again.
Yeah, and it would be... They're probably the least talked about of the four remaining nations, aren't they? And you know, I agree with you. They're fantastic achievement. Their consistency says it all. They keep getting to the latter stages. They came up just short against Great Britain. They probably won't win it this year, but... Be a great story.
They'll keep trying, won't they?
Yeah, and they might. That's the thing. It's against Australia for them next, and I don't know. Goffin is now, although he's ranked just outside the top 10 at the moment. He's starting to feel like a top 10 player. He's been inside just for about a week, hasn't he? But he's somebody who kind of never lets you down. He always moves through a tennis draw. And I like that. I've got a lot of respect for him, especially because physically he isn't an imposing kind of physique at all, is he? And yet he just...
No, that's a very kind way of putting it. I mean, pound for pound, he's, you know, he's top three in the world, isn't he, really? David Goffin. So he won both of his singles rubber. Steve Darcy. He won his singles rubber against Paolo Lorenzi, and the Italians won the doubles. And I'm not going to count dead rubbers because there was a lot of... this weekend, I would say, David, wasn't a brilliant advert for dead rubbers in Davis Cup, I think would be fair to say. And we'll come on to that specifically regarding the GB-France tie. But yeah, there was another victory. It ended up being 3-2, but I think in real terms, we'll call it 3-1 for Belgium in that tie. And as you say, they will now play Australia, who, as I correctly predicted, David, beat the United States of America pretty handily, I would say. Again, if we discount the dead rubber, which John Isner won for the United States, they beat them 3-1. The doubles tie, the doubles match was the only one that the Americans got on the board. Nick Kyrgios, obviously the hero, he won both of his singles rubbers in straight sets over Isner and Querrey. But Jordan Thompson stealing the limelight from Nick Kyrgios with a four-set win over Jack Sock. That was impressive stuff from the Aussies, wasn't it?
It was, and you know, I feel like it's taken a little bit of time for Leighton Hewitt to really get under the skin of this Australian team. He was unable to do it last year. This year, a year under the belt, a year of getting inside these guys' heads and engendering that spirit. And it matters more to him, Davis Cup success and participation and doing it for the nation's country colours than anything else I think he ever did in his career. And he's fostering that now within the rest of the team. And you know, what Davis Cup does when it's really played well and when it works is it makes certain players play better than they normally would. It creates results that you just wouldn't get the rest of the year. And I'm not convinced you would get Jordan Thompson beating Jack Sock in the majority of the run-of-the-mill ATP events. And that environment produced a performance out of Jordan Thompson the likes of which he may never produce again. I mean, I'm sure he's a good player, but seriously, that is a heck of a win against a guy who's knocking on the door of the top 10 in the world. And Jack Sock, kind of the opposite to some degree. I mean, I think he's perfectly capable of playing good Davis Cup tennis, but I saw him against Borna Coric, and he kind of withered a little last year in that environment. He had a great win over Marin Cilic, though, I should add, that same week. But this was a really big one for him. And then Kyrgios, I mean, the two stand side by side as stories for me. Jordan Thompson playing out of his skin and Kyrgios just not letting down. This is I keep waiting for him to hit the wall, physically, mentally, out of fatigue, and it's not happening. And that is, again, a building block in his journey towards, hopefully, where he will end up.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how he copes now with coming back to Europe for the start of the clay court swing, because that's not easy, is it? Just a quick trip back home to Australia, regardless of what class you're flying in. That's not easy to do that, to make that adjustment. I know it probably suits him very well on a number of levels because he does get homesick. He's somebody that's been very open with, you know, the struggles with life on tour away from the tennis, and I'm sympathetic with that. It's not easy for everyone, so I'm sure the popping home for a bit element of it is very positive for him. But physically, that's just an extra toil on top of the already pretty hard toil that is the ATP World Tour. So that's going to be interesting, I think. But very, very impressive from Australia, yeah, and an incredible moment for Jordan Thompson, and that was how the tie started off. So it really set the tone. And just talking about how important it is for Leighton Hewitt and for Australians, I mean, I remember Mark Philippoussis telling me that his Davis Cup victories mean more to him than any individual achievement. I think in terms of Australia producing future champions, a Davis Cup, and in terms of the profile of tennis in Australia and the popularity of it in a country which is sport obsessed and in which there are so many rival sports which talented kids could be getting involved in other than tennis, or could be choosing at that critical age other than tennis, I think a Davis Cup victory for them would do more for tennis in Australia than any individual win ever could, even at the Australian Open, I believe. I really do believe that. Moving on to Rouen, that beautiful, beautiful Normandy town of Rouen, where Monet painted so much of his best work. I'm really trying to rehabilitate my relationship with Rouen after rather mistakenly doing it down a few months ago. It did look like a delightful place. I saw Sue Barker walking through the streets of Rouen for her intros, and it looked just lovely. Not so lovely for the GB Davis Cup team, it has to be said, because barring a reasonably valiant effort from the doubles chaps, it was a pretty miserable time in France for GB, wasn't it?
It was. First time that Leon Smith's team has lost in 2 days, and I personally thought that it would go to 3 days, partly because I thought Kyle Edmund might get a win, actually, in that first rubber against Luca Puy, who handled Edmund's game on clay really well. There wasn't actually a huge amount in those first two sets. They very easily could have split those first two sets. That might have changed things, but Puy showed a real strength of character, as much as the talent he's obviously got. I wasn't 100% sure that he would be able to cope with it all, and because not everybody can, and he did an excellent job of that. Dan Evans showed that, frankly, that the surface is just, it's just a nightmare for him, and Jeremy Shardy played really well, but still, you know, Evans just looks as though he doesn't really know what you do on clay, and that's pretty much what he said afterwards. The doubles was also close. It was the one tie in which Great Britain got a set on the board, but there is strength and consistency all the way through that French team, and even with four or five notable dropouts through various circumstance, injury and lack of form, and in Joe Wilfried Tsonga's case, becoming a dad, that was a very, very good French performance, inspired by a captain who has been there and done it, both as a player and as a captain twice. He's carried and led France to victory on two different occasions. Yannick Noah, somebody that you and I know from the Champions Tour, and who has a charisma that is off the charts, really. I think the British team were quite taken aback by his level of charisma at the opening dinner, the opening ceremony that they have, in which Noah was getting the entire room singing along a cappella with him. The guy can have a room in the palm of his hand like nobody I've ever seen. He has people sitting there in blazers singing with him. I mean, I don't know anybody else in tennis who could do that.
Yeah, he is a deeply charismatic man, Yannick Noah. Of course, he's actually more famous in France now for being a singer-songwriter, isn't he, than actually for being... I mean, he's obviously still very famous for his tennis achievements, but I believe he's more famous for his musical achievements, which is a very odd but sort of quite wonderful thought, really. Yeah, we did talk about it going to a third day, that tie. It was a valiant effort by the doubles guys. I don't think it was Dom Inglot's best day. I think he's going to be kicking himself a bit. Obviously, he had that backhand put away on set point in the first set, which he will very much be kicking himself about. Doubles, it's very much teamwork. It wasn't all his fault, but I'm just pointing out that they did have chances and perhaps that doubles match could have gone another way on another day. But they were still in the position that even if they won that doubles, GB by then were in a position where Dan Evans was having to win a match against a top 20 player on clay in France in order for GB to win that tie or to even have a chance of winning that tie. And that seemed so desperately unlikely, I'm afraid to say. And I think probably in Dan's mind by that point, after the chastening experience he had in his opening rubber, it was probably desperately unlikely as well. He just clearly was so uncomfortable. I think it's as much to do with his size as it is his style of play, because the ball just rears up on him and he doesn't know really what to do, whether to step in and take it early or to wait and hang back. And he couldn't get into the net in the way that he likes to, and he couldn't really make good use of his serve. And it was just all wrong for him, wasn't it? And I didn't enjoy seeing Dan Evans so at sea, really. It wasn't a particularly enjoyable match to watch. The Kyle Edmund match against Luca Puy, not a terrible performance, certainly for the first couple of sets. Obviously, had those opportunities in the tiebreak, which it's a real shame that he didn't take that tiebreak. What was he, 5-2, 4-1, 5-2, I think. I know John Lloyd in the commentary, but controversial talking point here, said, you know, as much as he's full of admiration for Kyle Edmund, really likes the guy, admires his talent, all the rest of it, he said he feels he falls away a little too easily in a match, particularly in a five-set match, when he has lost the opening two sets. He felt like the fight ebbed away in that third set in a way that didn't necessarily please him. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I can see where John's coming from, actually, and the record would suggest that. I think I read a statistic from one of the journalists out there saying that he's yet to get a set on the board or when he's two sets to love down, and that tells its own story to some degree. I don't necessarily think it's lack of fight. I mean, in as much as I think Kyle Edmund has got as good an attitude as just about any young player out there in many ways, I think it's a mental letdown, of almost a bit of depression mid-match, where he just gets down. I think he finds it hard to believe that this is going to turn around. And I think one of the problems is that Kyle Edmund is a plan A tennis player. And he put his plan A on the board there against Luca Puy, and he went two sets to love down. And I think it becomes quite difficult for him to know what else to do. He basically needs to have one of those situations and fight his way through it, because he's a learner, isn't he? He's somebody who gets better with experience. I think he will work it out, because physically I think he's getting stronger all the time. He's somebody who's methodical. He's not going to just disappear in terms of going away for weeks on end. I dare say he'll come out in Monte Carlo next week and put in a good performance. You know, he's not somebody who'll have a drift like that. But I think John's making a fair point in terms of, at the moment, mid-match, if it starts to go against him two sets to love down, yes, I you don't have that confidence that there's a comeback coming. But that may well change in time.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, David, for a change.
Dan Evans,
we're getting back on track after a dodgy start, aren't we?
I found it quite... I can't believe this agreeing with me. Just a short point about Dan Evans. Since the last podcast, read in the newspapers, the pieces done by people like Simon Briggs in The Telegraph, that that he'd been and the British team had been consulting Tim Henman because of the similarity in styles of games between Evans and Henman, about Henman, how he conquered clay in 2004, getting to the semi-finals. And I mean, I think it's, you know, it's perhaps a bit too much of a stretch to think, oh, here's a tactic, go do it, you can do it. Now, for a start, Tim Henman's obviously a better player than Dan Evans is. But he,
ooh,
well, he is, isn't he? But at the same time, I think that it takes time, years and years of trying it, doing it, probably to conquer it. I remember seeing Tim Henman in 1998. I remember standing courtside in Monte Carlo. It was my, one of my first ever tournament weeks on the ATP circuit. And I thought, I'll go out and watch Tim Henman play on clay against Galo Blanco. And Tim looked almost as...
Now coach of Karen Khachanov.
Oh, really?
Is that right?
Oh, that's interesting.
I think
know
so. And Medvedev, actually. Yeah.
Well, and
they both train with him in Barcelona.
And he was part of the he was part of the Milos Raonic coaching team early on, Galo Blanco. But I remember watching this match courtside and thinking that Tim looked as almost as clueless as I do on a clay court in terms of just general coordination. He didn't know whether to stand at the back and try and loop these balls back and forth or whether to do what he normally does. And he got beaten heavily in straight sets. And suddenly, you know, 6 years later, it's not suddenly, but 6 years later, he'd adapted his style and was beating very, very good clay courters to get to the semi-finals of the French Open and not being
well,
too far away.
Arguably the closest he came to winning a slam.
It was the most uplifting.
In fact, I would say that probably was the closest he came to winning a slam. He was, what was he, a set in 4-1?
Yeah.
Against Guillermo Correa, had he won that, he'd have had Gaston Gaudio in the final.
Yeah.
I mean, he was playing sensational tennis.
So I wonder whether
that whole year,
2004. I wonder whether Evans, if he were to commit to it and actually say, all right, well, I'm going to just keep having a go at this, but playing my way, I wonder whether he could at least become more comfortable on it, you know?
However, before we go too deep into this discussion, I mean, obviously he can become more comfortable. I would doubt whether he can complete the sort of transformation that Tim Henman did on clay. Of course he can become more comfortable. I rather feel this discussion might be academic because will he commit to it, David? Will he?
Well, I mean...
I just don't know.
If he's going to stay in the top 50...
He hasn't played a match on clay since 2014, May 2014. He managed to go 3 years...
That is funny.
...without stepping onto clay. I have to say... that is really impressive.
He's on. I'm just looking at the Monte Carlo entry list. He's on it. Yeah. And this is the thing. Whilst he's in the top 50 in the world, he qualifies for these tournaments, you know. I mean, he hasn't got to play Monte Carlo. Just a little step back. I notice as well that Kyrgios is on that entry list for Monte Carlo. And I'm just kind of thinking that at the moment, it might not be the worst thing in the world for him if he were to have a bit of a rest right now, because it's a lot of travelling, a lot of work, and I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on how he feels. I don't know how he feels. It's 6 of 1 and a half dozen of the other, isn't it? Because he's clearly on a roll at the moment. He's clearly in the zone. He's clearly enjoying his tennis, enjoying working hard on his tennis, and almost if he stops the roll, it might be easier to not fall back into bad habits. That sounds really patronising, but, you know, sort of get into a different mindset, you know, fall into a different mindset. So it might be easier just to press on. He always plays well in Madrid. I think he enjoys the altitude there. Generally, the sort of the less naturally good players who are, I suppose, less naturally inclined to enjoy the clay tend to enjoy playing in Madrid because of the altitude, because it plays a bit differently to a normal clay court, I suppose. So he does usually play well there. So I'd definitely expect him to play Madrid and Rome, which of course are back-to-back. That's pretty exhausting. His girlfriend is based in Miami, isn't she? So maybe he'll want to squeeze in some time there. I don't know. Maybe. It all depends on how he feels and that's unknown. Tweet us, Nick. Tweet us and let us know how you're feeling.
Yeah, because he's a definite listener.
David Law would love to know.
Actually, his brother's a listener. Hello, Nick Kyrgios' brother. But anyway.
Whose name you've definitely just forgotten.
Yeah, I think it's Chris, isn't it? I don't know. Chris, I don't know.
Christos?
Yeah, hello, Christos. So anyway, you know.
Hello.
We're talking about your brother. There we are. So what?
For a change. And Serbia beat Spain, David.
They did.
Hang on. While we're in France, let's just do this geographically. Aliash Bedene has won another absolutely cracking challenger event. And I know people listening are probably going, oh, challenger, what's the big deal winning another challenger? Well, he beat Benoit Paire in the final, 6-2, 6-2. So that probably tells you about the field at this challenger. It was played at Patrick Mouratoglou's recently opened academy in the south of France, which sounds delightful. I've not been, but I'm sure it's a level of stylish and lovely commensurate with Patrick's stylishness and loveliness. What a great week for him. And Andy Murray gave him the trophy, and I just feel so positive for him that he was doing something so positive. He could have been at home, head in hands, having a cry, watching the Davis Cup on the telly, just feeling terrible about the world, which I feel might have been what he'd have been doing this time last year, frankly. And instead, he was in France, a couple of hundred kilometres down the world, playing great tennis and receiving his winner's trophy from Andy Murray, who was out there completing a training block. I mean, I just think good for him, good for Andy.
It does show, again, I mean, and you mentioned whether people might think, oh, just a challenger. These are tough tournaments to win, and these are often top 100 players or just outside the top 100, and it is a bun fight trying to get points on the board. And this is the second of those that Bedene's won, and he is such a loss to the British team in that they did not succeed with that appeal. I think that they still harbour some hope of appealing again and getting a more positive result next time. But just imagine if you'd have put him in that tie. I'm not saying it would have been a different result, but it certainly would have given Britain an option, a better option than they had ultimately, because it's that depth, isn't it, that they lack. And Andy Murray, it sounds as though he's making progress. He's not there yet. I read some quotes today that he's still not serving as hard as he wants to be able to serve because of the elbow problem he's had. But at the moment, he's still on the Monte Carlo entry list. I would have guessed it would be probably touch and go as to whether he'll actually make it for that.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, it's pleasing to hear that he's training again. But it seems touch and go to me. What's he got now? I mean, he's got realistically probably 5 or 6 days now before he has to make the decision. And I just don't see him taking any risks. He's got a decent cushion rankings wise. Okay, he reached semis of Monte Carlo last year, but I don't think that's going to trouble him too much. I don't see him taking any risks.
He's playing that exhibition against Federer today, isn't he?
Yeah. But that's, that's an exhibition.
Yeah, no, it is.
Speaking of which, we will talk about Spain-Serbia in a minute. Just quickly, since you've mentioned exhibition tennis, the dead rubbers in that France-GB tie, it did make a bit of a mockery of dead rubbers, didn't it?
Yeah, I can't say I didn't see it. I didn't wait around to
Well, I mean, essentially one of them turned into a sort of Champions Tour-esque, well, sub-Champions Tour-really-esque, exhibition match where Yannick Noah was on the court. There were three French players on the court at one point.
In singles.
Playing against Danev. In singles, yeah. I'm not exaggerating.
Three
it really,
French players
really
against
was.
Dan Evans. Yeah, and Evans was playing along. And, I mean, Noah, I think, produces an exhibition-type environment the likes of which you've never seen. Maybe Barami, but in terms of just sheer exhilaration, it is worth watching Yannick Noah putting on a show.
Oh, look,
but
I'm not
on that stage.
For the fans, if I had been in that crowd, I'd rather have watched a jokey, charismatic exhibition involving Yannick Noah and Dan Evans than a atmosphereless, dull, dead rubber. But it does, I'm just saying, it makes them, at a time and in a climate where the schedule is such a hot topic and reform of the Davis Cup in terms of the time and the energy that it takes out of the players. I mean, that was a completely wasted day for everyone, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
In a sport where days are at a premium.
No, it was. And I mean, look, it felt like
I don't have an answer.
It felt like
the
right thing in under the wrong circumstances in many ways, just because it is, you'd be better off just billing it as Dead Rubber Day, meaning an exhibition, rather than, because I mean that thing counted 3-1 and it counted, but in terms of the actual scoreline, but Dan Evans ended up winning that. But no, I mean it is one of those unsatisfactory elements of the Davis Cup, no question.
Novak Djokovic was back in action against Spain. We only saw him once because Serbia was so dominant in their tie against Spain. They won they only needed 3 rubbers. They didn't need the final day either. They had a match on their hands in the doubles, needed 5 sets to win that. Troicki and Zimonjic to seal the tie. But before that, Troicki and Djokovic had both won their singles rubbers in straight sets against Carreño Busta and Ramos Vinolas, respectively. As convincing a Davis Cup victory as there could be. Okay, not a fully fully replete Spanish side, some very notable absences, but nonetheless, Davis Cup is all about showing off your strength and depth, isn't it? They had a decent team, but crucially, actually, not crucially in this tie, Serbia had Novak Djokovic, but it was very much a team effort on this occasion.
And a good decision, I would say, from Novak Djokovic to play. Not only because it helped Serbia get through, but I just feel that he needs to feel better about playing tennis again. And I think that will have just cheered him up, quite honestly. And I mean, it was the team environment winning the Davis Cup that was the launch pad for his 2011 season, it felt like. And I think that this is a good move from Djokovic. I heard that he's planning to play the semi-finals no matter what happens the rest of the year as well with his singles career. And I think sometimes it can just do you the world of good. I think it did Andy Murray the world of good, didn't it? Winning the Davis Cup in 2015. So, I think good decision.
Yeah, I'd agree. We now have the prospect of semi-finals where, looking at it, I would expect 3 of the 4 sides, France is the only one with a question mark, to field their very best players. We're going to see the national number ones for those teams, injury permitting, fitness permitting. We are going to see David Goffin play for Belgium. We'll see Nick Kyrgios play for Australia. We will see Novak Djokovic play for Serbia. France, we know there's all sorts of weird things going on with France, with Gael Monfils in particular, and they have so many players sort of around about the same ranking as well, that it's less of an issue with them. But that's good news for the Davis Cup, that we are going to see the top players from most of those nations competing in the semi-finals for me. Just quickly, before we move on to talk about the WTA events that were happening this year, Nick Kyrgios has been... I know we've talked about Nick Kyrgios a lot already, but we must mention the fact that he is selling his car on Facebook, David.
Awesome. You've got to love that.
He's selling his prize... he said it was his first car, a BMW of some description. He's selling it on Facebook, yeah. He's open to offers, although not insulting offers.
I particularly liked some of the exchanges he had with certain people. Somebody said, oh, yeah, that sounds great. I've got $6,000 here. And he said, yeah, I'll send you the wing mirror, mate.
Yeah.
Got to laugh. But anyway, yeah, Nick Kyrgios doing it his way.
So if you are in the market for a used vintage BMW, head over to Nick Kyrgios' Facebook and grab yourself a bargain. I presume, being based in the... where's he based? Is he still based in Canberra or is he based in Melbourne in Australia? Whatever state of Australia he's based in, I'd imagine being within driving distance of that is a fairly critical element to being eligible to buy that car, or else you're going to have some pretty hefty shipping costs on your hand. But anyway, let's talk about the WTA events that have been happening this week. In Monterey, the lovely Monterey, best aquarium I've ever been to in Monterey, David. And I don't say that lightly because I love an aquarium and I've been to many, but the one in Monterey is truly breathtaking. and in Charleston. Which would you like to talk about first, David?
Well, given that you've already started on Monterey with your sort of Lonely Planet
guide.
Well,
only because I've not been to Charleston. I've heard great things. Apparently the food there is to die for. I've heard some great things about what they do with melted cheese. But I've not been. I've not experienced it myself.
What are they doing with melted cheese?
I just put it on everything, which sounds great. Thanks. whereas I have been to Monterey and I have been to that aquarium and my mind was blown. So, Monterey, Kerber versus Pavlyuchenkova in the final. Shock horror. Pavlyuchenkova beat Kerber. How much do we read into this in terms of the Kerber narrative that we've got going on? Is it a great week because she reached a final, or was it a not quite great week because she lost to Pavlyuchenkova in the final?
Yeah, difficult one, isn't it? I mean, look, I look at it as a good week. She's got to the final and she's punched the clock and kept going forwards. And Pavlyuchenkova is somebody who, when she's on, can take the play away from you, no matter who you are. So I'm still surprised. I didn't see that match. It was it was overnight our time, but I was sort of following it vaguely on Twitter just before going to bed, and saw that Pavlyuchenkova was getting back into it, and really, you know, she can hit the ball pretty much as hard as anybody, and so if she's middling it, that can be problems for someone like Kerber, who hasn't always had the best clay court results. She does really well in Stuttgart, which we'll have in a few weeks' time, and that's about it, really. So, I don't know, I wouldn't read too much, certainly anything really negative into that result from a Kerber perspective, but the only thing you would say is world number ones don't tend to lose finals very often. That's the only thing I would say, is that I think Kerber, I just don't see her producing at any stage this year the sort of tennis she produced last year. I think that was...
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why UnitedHealthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Probably a bit of a one-off year-wise.
In Charleston, David, home of the melted cheese and other culinary delights, Daria Kazatkina, I know a favourite of yours, a favourite of everyone's, really, has been busy winning her first title and crying, and it was all very emotional and heartwarming, and she's great, isn't she? She's just great.
She is. I should just say, I've just been talking about Monterey as though it was a clay court tournament, but it wasn't, of course. It was Charleston that was the clay court tournament. But anyway, Kerber did well, I thought, to get to that final. In Charleston,
You could have been forgiven for thinking Charleston wasn't a clay court tournament, because on the telly, in all the clips, it looks like, I mean, it looks grey, doesn't it? Apparently it is green clay,
yeah,
but it looks grey.
It's the least attractive looking of all the the options really, I think, out there. I'd like to have Blue Clay back if anybody's listening, if anybody fancies.
You and Roger Federer both, yeah. David.
Let's stick down a Blue Clay court in Charleston is what I say. And a couple of other areas would be nice too, I think. But anyway, Charleston, I saw some of that final. You couldn't get two more different players in terms of personality, I don't think, than Daria Kasatkina, who seems just delightful and a real breath of fresh air, both in terms of the way she plays the sport and the way she reacted to her win. She was in floods of tears after winning her first title. It meant so much to her. She obviously played very well. She's a very clever player, very thoughtful player. She actually plays tactically. She just doesn't just belt the ball. And I find her a joy to watch. I really do. I love watching her. Somebody I read last night compared her style-wise to Martina Hingis, and I can see that comparison. There's a lot going on there in terms of the way she plays. Yelena Ostapenko is an incredible ball striker, but she is so impetuous and so frustrating to watch at times because you never know quite what is going to come next. And she's stroppy, and she was not happy at losing. And she said in her post-match speech, you know, I played my worst match of the week. So, yeah.
It's not... I mean, I sort of love that because you know that probably most of the time that's what players really want to say in their runners-up speech. And what a horribly painful thing it is that runners up, usually when you lose a tennis match, unless it's a final, you get to walk off the court and do whatever you want in the privacy of the locker room. If it's a final, which is when it's going to hurt the most, you have to sit there on the court and experience all of your emotions in front of everyone and give a speech and watch the person that's just beaten you being as happy as Larry. It's tough. And Yelena Ostapenko is young, and yes, I doubt she'll make that mistake again. I'm sure she'd have been told off by various people, including Elena Vesnina, who tweeted, "What a speech from Daria Kasatkina. Can't say the same about her opponent," which probably reflects the feelings of most people. But look, she's young. She was in the moment. She was being honest. I've got quite a lot of sympathy for Yelena.
Oh, come on. We need more of that. We need more of just people just saying, "I'm really annoyed. I'm really annoyed. Yeah. I've played rubbish. I'd have beaten her no problem had I been at my best. And, you know, sorry, Daria, just deal with it. That would have happened. It didn't."
Federer sometimes does it, doesn't he? In his Federer-esque way, he says, "Congratulations, Rafa, on a great match. I was just too good today." I love that. Daria Kasatkina is good news all around. I think Yelena Ostapenko generally is good news. But yeah, she can be brilliant, or she can be a bit horrifying. But it's
two players
good to
with
watch,
great
isn't
facial
it?
Expressions. So you know exactly what is going on at every moment with those two. I like that.
Yeah, I'd agree with everything, David. Daria Kasatkina, good news for the sport. Yelena Ostapenko, for me, also good news for the sport. Those two being in the final together, good news. And I think Daria Kasatkina winning and how much it meant to her, all the rest of it, it's all good news.
It is good news, yeah. And I was delighted. But I would say there is one issue, isn't there, in that although I was able to watch that on BT Sport over here in the UK, not everywhere has access to the WTA circuit at the moment, do they?
No. For those that don't know, I'm sure lots of the sort of real tennis geeks out there will know, but you can be forgiven perhaps for not knowing. Tennis TV, the online viewing streaming platform for tennis, used to be ATP and WTA. As of 2017, it only shows ATP matches. The WTA has withdrawn their deal. I don't know the details of how it came about, but the WTA tour is no longer available on Tennis TV, and they haven't as yet set up their own separate streaming service. So tennis fans, WTA fans, don't have the choice of any old WTA match they want to watch. If they don't happen to have a broadcaster available to them in their country that is showing the match that they want to watch, there is no other alternative available, much to the chagrin of tennis fans, WTA fans. Media in particular are really up in arms about it. Steve Simon, CEO of WTA, says There are plans to put their own streaming platform in place, but it's unlikely to happen before autumn of this year at the very earliest, by the sounds of it. To me, it sounds like it's going to be 2018, realistically, before anything's in place. And that is just, I mean, it's not great, is it? It's just not great. It's a backward step. You've gone from every match being available to sometimes there being a tennis match on that, depending on what country you're in, feels like, you know, it's happening in a black hole. You literally cannot watch it, which we're so used to having everything at our fingertips now anytime we want it, aren't we, with Netflix and Amazon and tennis TV and all the rest of it. You expect to just somehow, whether you have to pay or not, being able to find the match you want to watch. And sometimes it is literally not possible to watch these tennis matches. They're sort of happening in a vacuum.
And we have the same problem with the Davis Cup at the moment, because they used to have an option of streaming on the DavisCup.com website. And I think probably since the deal with, I think it's beIN Sports now owns the TV rights for the Davis Cup, and that is no longer available in that form. Like yourself, I'm not 100% sure what happened with Tennis TV, but I remember Steve Simon doing an interview with Ben Rothenberg at the start of the year or late last year and saying that certainly for the first quarter of this year, we would be unlikely to have any streaming option of the WTA circuit. Well, as you say, now we're looking at the third quarter, maybe the fourth quarter getting some of it, maybe not even this year at all. And in this era where, as you say, everything is available pretty much everywhere else, that is a big blow, and it's not really good enough.
No, I agree, it's not really good enough, and I think they realise it's not really good enough, but they don't have an answer yet. They can't say, we know it's not good enough, but don't worry, we'll have something in place by this date. They're not, obviously not yet in a position to be able to say that as much as they desperately want to, so watch this space. On the subject of other controversial and interesting talking points relating to the WTA, Mary Carrillo, who, a former tennis player, broadcast with the Tennis Channel, for me, one of, if not the best tennis broadcaster around today. I think she is magnificent in every way. She has done a very entertaining, very interesting, very edgy, not that you'd expect anything less from Mary Carrillo, very edgy interview with Steve Simon, the CEO of the WTA, for Tennis Channel. It's available on the Tennis Channel website if you didn't see it, and I would recommend you take a look. She did not shy away from the big topics, did she? And it wasn't an easy watch, David, is what I would say about it. I mean, it was fascinating, and it was an important interview, I think, but not an easy watch for fans of tennis, and women's tennis in particular, obviously.
Yeah, well, it touched on the on-court coaching that we've been debating. Mary Carrillo is not a fan in any way, shape or form. She is very strong in the opinion that it just looks bad for women and women's tennis generally to have men coming onto the court, or anybody coming onto the court, and having the sort of conversation whereby they are saying, it's going to be okay, and don't worry, and all this sort of thing, rather than anything specifically tactical. Obviously, you raised the point about the Darren Cahill one from last week against Joe Konta. She also touched on the subject of grunting. And in truth, I felt as though Steve Simon didn't really have reasoning and answers behind the stance that he and the WTA were taking on the various issues. One is that coaching and on-court coaching was going to carry on. Personally, and Mary Carrillo used the examples of the Williams sisters and how good she thought it was that the Williams sisters did not use on-court coaching, and that everybody else does. She felt it's a bad look that they don't do it and everybody else does. My view is that difference is good, and I have no problem with having that facility there. The fact that they don't use it, great. I have no problem with that either. We discussed it in depth last week. On the subject of the grunting, Steve Simon was making the point that there is the impeding your opponent rule, but the fact is that there is no obvious solution to what to do about on-court coaching. I mean, I would say that maybe an umpire could take that on themselves at some point or at a certain measurement to say, all right, that's it. That's enough now. There's too much. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that interview and what was interesting about it wasn't necessarily about the specifics of the issues. I happen to disagree with Mary Carrillo on both the main points that she raised on on-court coaching and on grunting. I very strongly disagree with her. I found her arguments very compelling and coherent, exactly as you'd expect, but I just disagree with her. I've made my arguments about on-court coaching. I think she has a very good point, one that we didn't raise, about the fact that they're not tactical enough. Too often it's just sort of an arm around the shoulder and it's a bit wafty, and perhaps that needs to be looked at. Look, my argument, I think it's very similar to yours, still stands, that on-court coaching is a good thing. It just needs some reform and some real thought to go into it. I don't accept the argument that it's a bad thing it is a bad thing that the ATP and the Grand Slams don't do it, but I see that as the WTA leading the way. And again, I think there's some sexism in the way that's perceived. I think if the ATP were doing it and the WTA weren't, it would be seen as, you know, the ATP making this bold decision to lead the way in tennis rather than the way it's sort of looked at in women's tennis, which is, oh, how pathetic that they're doing it and the ATP, you know, don't need to. With the grunting, for me, that is not an issue at all. And again, I think it's perceived. It's impossible to disentangle it from the sort of sexist climate and the sexist sort of atmosphere in which it's viewed. I mean, a lot grunting in men's tennis is a thing as well, and nobody talks about it. It's this, you know, women should be seen and not heard, and it's sort of unladylike for women to grunt in a way that, you know, for men it's fine because it's just showing sort of how athletic and masculine and how much effort they're putting in. I completely accept that, you know, the sound of grunting is not necessarily pleasant for people to hear, but the fact that women's tennis gets so assaulted with it all the time as a negative, I think it's impossible to detach that from a generally sexist climate. And look, I don't happen to be particularly irritated by it. I sort of am able to zone it out. I realise that some people are more irritated by it than others. What was most interesting for me about the interview was Steve Simon's failure to, as it happened, I agreed with Steve Simon and the WTA's position on those two issues. And yet he did such a poor job of defending the WTA's stance, defending and explaining his and the WTA's stance on those issues. You know, Mary Carrillo was so eloquent and so punchy and so coherent in explaining her reasoning for how she felt about those issues. As I say, I disagreed with her and I agreed with Steve Simon, and yet he had nothing. He just sort of meekly sort of, I don't know what he did, really. He didn't even, it was sort of politician diplomacy stuff, but not even that great diplomacy. There are issues that I very strongly disagree with Steve Simon's stance on. The Sharapova situation and various statements that he's put out is one of them. That didn't come up in that interview. I wanted to shake him and go, explain it better, Steve, explain it better, because this is your chance. And he just sort of wanted it to be over and for the onslaught of questions to end.
The only thing
and
I would say
that's
is...
that's not good enough, really.
I only saw a 3 or 4 minute edit of that interview. I'd quite like to see the uncut version. And I wondered whether some of the edits were making it look worse than it was. But no, I mean, the overriding feeling was that, come on, Steve, you could give proper answers and better answers to this. You don't need to just be taking this, because there are some answers that one could come up with.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, exactly. There are answers there. I'm sure there's great thought and logic behind the stance that the WTA takes on these issues, and all he needed to do was, you know, really coherently and strongly explain that. Plenty would still disagree with him. I'm sure he wouldn't persuade Mary Carrillo on those points, but she's a person of so much integrity. She would have accepted a good, strong, robust defence, I think, and it wasn't there. And that for me was a little bit worrying. But as you say, I'm in the same position. I've only seen the edit. It's possible that it was edited for a bit of effect, because certainly it was entertaining. In Mary Carrillo was not for turning, was she? She wasn't going to back down. She had so much integrity in that interview. I really found it impressive. But no resolution, I don't think, to an unsatisfying level of unresolved issues, I think, resulting from that interview. What else have we got? I know you wanted to mention Henry Konta and David, because we probably should have mentioned him last week, shouldn't we?
Yeah, well, he just in as much as he's just become world number one doubles player and is somebody who doesn't get a lot of attention. Doubles generally doesn't get that much attention, certainly not as much as it should do, and we're as guilty of that as anybody. You know, I'm afraid it just does tend to fly below the radar a lot of the time. But you know, he's somebody who, with John Peers, they won the ATP Tour Finals last year. They won the Australian Open at the start of this year. He was unable to carry on, or decided not to carry on, a singles career because of his physical frailty, really, and an inability to stand up to the rigors of the sport, and he went doubles only, and here he is at world number one from Finland, and I think it's a fantastic story for him. He's a really exciting doubles player to watch, so dynamic, so congratulations to him. Just wanted to touch on that.
Yep, likewise, congratulations, Henry Konta. You got anything else, David? Any other business?
I have one other thing here, which was brought to my attention by a listener, which was just about the clay court season, which is upcoming, and whether we think there will be any big breakthrough. Political Rat at Tennis Podcast wants to know, any big breakthrough this clay season, or do you want to give it a week, Catherine, to wait for the Monte Carlo preview?
We can talk about it again. Any big breakthrough in terms of a specific player?
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what, I think, right, that both Kyrgios and Zverev have the ability to transfer their games onto clay and get a big result this spring. And what I mean by that is to make a final of a Masters series, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a particularly bold prediction, David. But, okay. I wouldn't call...
Let's hear yours then.
Oh, you've got me on the spot. You've had more time with this. This was not on the agenda that you sent me. I have been...
Right, well, I'll give you 1 week to come up with a bold prediction that's
okay.
Frankly more bold than the one I just came up with.
I mean, Zverev reaching a Masters final on clay, that would be... I mean, it's only a matter of time. He is going to do that quite soon. So I don't think it's bold in that respect. But I suppose
he hasn't done it yet,
or Rome would be quite a big deal. Sorry?
He's a teenager and he hasn't done it yet.
Yeah, I'm giving, but I don't think Kyrgios reaching a Masters final. I mean, he should be reaching lots of Masters finals. I expect
on clay.
Him to do it,
I mean, how many people are able to transfer that skill on from surface to surface?
Yeah, but we've already seen it from Kyrgios. I said how well he plays in Madrid. I think he could very easily reach the Madrid final. And also, with that serve, does it really matter what surface that serve is coming at you on?
Boris Becker had a good serve, and Andy Roddick. How did they do on clay? I think I've just won.
I will think about it, David.
Okay.
I will think about it and get back to you next week.
Lovely.
How's that?
Lovely. You played tennis this week? You playing tennis over the next few days? Or?
Haven't played tennis this week. My brother's had an exam to revise for, and I seem to have no other people in my life willing to play tennis with me.
So. I'll take you off.
So, no thanks. Well, I mean, you're in Birmingham, so that's a problem, isn't it?
No thanks is my answer. Brilliant.
Yeah, no thanks. But I think we'll be having some Easter tennis this week.
Excellent.
How about you?
Excellent.
Any tennis in the offing?
No, none at all. No, I just watch.
You're getting
talk.
That much needed practice in then.
No, I will do though. By the time we play our match, I'll tell you, I'll be ready.
We've already played our match, David, and I won. This has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. I love presenting this thing because I can just, you know, finish on whatever note I like. We have been the Tennis Podcast. It has been a pleasure, mostly, to broadcast to you this week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And we'll be back in a week's time.